This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Just to please your ears, these local musicians work hard all year long, but they take this day to stop and salute KPFT. The $10 door fee benefits the station. So come on out and enjoy a slice of the other red meat. Icy cold watermelon. 1403 Nan Street, the address for the Last Concert Cafe. Saturday, July 28th is the date. We'll see you out there. 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Polinsky.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
Tonight on the show, David Elliott calls us from Washington with the Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. David will talk about Scooter Libby and what fun that was this past week watching the news, and how this is going to impact the progressive politics for the U.S. for a generation to come. Then we're going to be talking to Jeff Reed about Political Beat Reporter, and hopefully Dalton DeHart, our community photographer, will be on a little bit later, plus all that wonderful stuff from This Way Out, the internationally syndicated news magazine, and including NewsWrap. So we're sort of getting back to the groove here in the community after Pride.
Well, I don't know. I'm so damp from the humidity and so hot from the heat, and I have this lovely O'Day insect repellent cologne that I have to wear all the time.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it, and I actually need some tips from you because I got bites all over the place. And
Avon Skin So Soft.
Okay, well.
It's excellent. It works. And I know because I go fishing.
Okay.
As a proper lesbian, you know.
Well.
And I wear it when I go fishing and I don't get bit.
Good. Good for you. And that's probably more than we wanted to know on that subject. And usually this is like the post-Pride depression time. But there's so much going on in the community that we don't have time for that.
Yeah, well, there are some things going on at Pride apparently to be depressed about. But we'll talk about that a little bit later in the program.
Yes, we will.
So I think we might have David on the line from Washington, D.C.
Good evening, David. How hot is it there?
Oh, boy, I tell you, Jack and Deborah, you know, it's good to hear your voices. We are experiencing the heat wave. It hit here today, a high of 98, heat index into the 100s. But, you know, why am I telling you this? Because you live in Houston.
Well, yes, like it's so much different here.
Right.
So what's going on in Washington?
Jack, you know, Deborah, I have something really important that I want to talk to you all about tonight.
Okay.
You have all heard the adage, young people don't vote.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Deborah, have you heard that?
I certainly have.
You know what? It's no longer true.
Good.
I've been crunching some numbers that have just come to our attention lately, and we have a coming revolution in electoral politics in this country. Actually, it's not coming. It began in 2004 and then 2006, but it's going to continue. It probably is going to affect the 2008 elections. By the year 2016, it is going to affect progressive politics in this country as we know it, and is going to turn everything upside down. So I want to talk to you a little bit about this. And this is kind of complicated stuff, you know. It's an issue that it would be very easy to write an essay in a political magazine about, or an op-ed piece, and it doesn't translate as well when it comes to the radio. So I want to take it a little bit slow.
Well, and you know, don't underestimate our audience, because we got a pretty clever audience out there.
Well, you certainly
all
do.
All three of them.
Yes.
Not going to go there. Not going to go there. But let me ask you a question. Jack, you've heard of the baby boomer generation.
Yes.
You've heard of Generation X.
Yes.
What is the word that describes the current up-and-coming generation? Do you know it?
You know, I thought I did, but now you put me on the spot.
Is it Z?
It's not Z. But Deborah, that was a darn good.
That was a pithy.
That was a good guess.
Yeah,
they're called the millennials.
Oh,
the millennials.
Isn't that a new action adventure movie coming out soon?
Oh, I don't know.
The millennials, and so these are people that are what ages now?
Well, basically, the millennials are anyone born in the 1980s or 1990s. So some of them are already old enough to vote. Some of them are 27 years old. Some of them are only 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're not going to become fully of age until about 2016, 2018, something like that. But this is a huge generation. I mean, consider that there are already about 90 million, 95 million millennials in this country compared with 78 million baby boomers.
Mm.
Now, to put those figures into perspective, there are about 300 million people in the U.S. So we see that already millennials make up almost one-third of all the people in this country, although a lot of them are too young. They can't vote yet. But I want to share some statistics with you if I can.
Okay.
In the 2006 elections, people who were in the 18 to 29-year-old age group voted for Democratic U.S. House candidates over Republican candidates by a whopping 22 percentage points, 60% to 38%. Now, go back to 2004. People who were 18 to 24-year-olds turned out to vote 47%, up 11 percentage points from the 36% turnout that was recorded among the same age group in 2000. Now, an interesting footnote, if only 18 to 29-year-olds had been allowed to vote in 2004, get this, John Kerry would have crushed President Bush in the Electoral College, 375 votes to 163. Among the southern, quote-unquote, Bush states that Kerry would have carried were Arkansas, Mississippi, North Carolina, and Virginia, and Kerry almost would have carried Alabama and even Texas.
Even Texas?
Now,
oh, my.
To put this into perspective, if you go way back to 1991 and interview 18 to 25-year-old Generation Xers, as we called them then, 55% identified themselves as being Republican, while 33% identified as being Democrats. In 2006, by contrast, looking at the same age group, 49% identified themselves as Democrats, compared with 35% as Republicans. So, here's the bottom line here, folks. In the course of one generation, Republicans managed to lose 20 percentage points of the youth vote, which is a virtual tsunami in the political culture of voter identification. Now, why do these numbers matter? What do they mean for the future of progressive politics in our country?
That's just what I'm wondering, David.
Well, first, Deborah, they matter because of the sheer size of the millennial generation. You know, as I mentioned earlier, millennials already outnumber baby boomers, and as we go forward from election to election, ultimately reaching a hilt in 2016, they're going to completely take over the country. But it matters for another reason, too. And this is another way that we've really crunched the polling, you know, some of the surveys that have been done recently. The millennials hold four unique values close to their hearts that generations before them did not hold. What are these four values?
Well, I'm guessing one is that they're not against gay marriage.
Well, Jack, you know, you just hit it. The first value is tolerance. You know, whether we're talking about race, gender, or sexual orientation, millennials are significantly more tolerant than their predecessors. For example, a survey taken earlier this year found that people who were 18 to 29 years old fully support gay marriage by the rate of 56% to 44%, where the public as a whole opposes gay marriage 55% to 45%. Mm-hmm. So you see a radical 11 percentage point shift, you know, between people 18 to 30 and the public as a whole. Another value they hold is multilateralism. They believe that we should talk to people in foreign countries instead of using our military first. And this belief probably comes from the fact that if you're on a college campus today, you know somebody who has been in Iraq, right?
Yes, and what a concept that is.
What a concept, right. A third value they hold is a belief in the environment. Millennials overwhelmingly believe that the country should do whatever it takes to protect the environment. They believe that stricter environmental laws and regulations are worth the cost, and that people should be willing to pay higher prices to protect the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And last, but certainly not least, especially for this radio program, a fourth belief that the millennials hold close to their hearts is a concern about inequality. Perhaps due to media exposure, you know, resulting from the Enron scandal and other scandals involving CEOs, millennials show a deep concern for income inequality and social stratification. In fact, a survey that was done in 2004 found that 84% of millennials said the gap between rich and poor had grown in the past 20 years, and 94% said that that change in the gap between rich and poor was a bad thing. So
that's really interesting.
We're on the verge of a revolution, and I think it's going to show up at the polls as early as November 2008. You already see a lot of youth support for Barack Obama for president. You know, of course, I don't endorse candidates for political office, and I don't
also, you know, it is as important as a presidential election is, and it is very important. So are all the other offices that are going to be up in the next couple of years.
Well, absolutely, and you know, this can bring us to electoral politics in the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
People across the country don't realize this, but Texas is only one, two, or three election cycles away from going Democratic. People stereotype the state of Texas as being a Republican state.
Mm-hmm.
It only began to be that way in 1994, and the pendulum is swinging back.
Yes.
We're going to see interesting things happen.
Yeah, but some of the ways the districts have been drawn because of Tom DeLay, that may be a little bit more difficult to do, but certainly there's hope for that.
There is hope. I mean, you look at November 2006 elections in Dallas County, where
yes.
Democrats won every single mm-hmm. judgeship mm-hmm. on the ballot. And you look at some different things going on. What the Democrats in Texas have to do, Jack, is they have to grow their bench.
Yes.
You know, I'm a big baseball fan, okay, Major League Baseball. And in Major League Baseball, what you have to do to succeed as a team is you have to grow your farm system.
Well, and that's exactly right. I mean, the Republicans were so good at getting people elected to school boards and city councils and all these, you know, other seats, and the Democrats just sort of let that happen. And finally, there is some movement here in Harris County, and Harris County is a little bit different than Dallas County because it's larger, meaning that it encompasses more of the conservative suburbs. But I think there is a good chance that we will turn it much more, it's much bluer in the next cycle, not the next cycle, the cycle after that, because this cycle is municipal elections.
And actually, in our municipal elections, we often have been more blue.
Well, the city is much bluer than the county. Yes.
Right, right. David, I have a couple of questions for you. One is, where do these numbers come from? Or is the data from different sources? Can you cite what specific polls?
Yes, that's an excellent question, Deborah. Thanks for asking that. The data comes from all over the map, but you can find the whole thing in a new report that just came out that anybody can go to their website and download. The report was published by the New Politics Institute, and their website is at www.newpolitics.net, and the name of the report is The Progressive Politics of the Millennial Generation.
And what are some of the things that might be cited as the reasons for this shift? Why are these younger people...
Do you think it would have something to do with the way the White House and the executive branch is running the country?
Well, it's a couple of things, and y'all are both onto something there. But I'll give you a for example, okay? One of the values that I didn't mention that the new millennials believe in deeply is the ability of government to make a difference for the good. This is in contrast to the baby boomers and Generation X, which basically didn't believe in government, had a very cynical attitude toward government, came of age during the Reagan era. The millennials came of age during Katrina.
Mm.
And they saw where government failed.
Failed miserably, yes.
Failed miserably.
And the war. It's failing miserably.
Yeah, look, in fact, that's right. Look at the multilateralism belief that they have. They have seen people go off to Iraq and Afghanistan and die.
Or be wounded for the rest of their life, yeah.
Right.
And that's really interesting because I read a book about 6 months ago talking about how the Republicans, with some few exceptions, will be in control for the next generation. But this was really before all of the mistakes and the mismanagement of the government by the executive branch. And at the same time, though, even though the Democrats took over Congress this past cycle, they really haven't made a lot of difference. And you're still seeing, you know, some of the corruption, some of the, you know, money going into special pots, and you know, there's also, of course, the thing that the Senate is only like one vote in the,
right,
the Democrat.
And even in the House, it's still a very slim majority.
It is very close, but I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb and make a prediction.
Okay, here's one of David's famous predictions.
I believe that by and large, a new progressive majority is going to emerge and is going to dominate Congress and the White House for not just a generation, but perhaps about a generation and a half to come. Now, let me offer one caveat, and that caveat is this. Political parties heal themselves. The Republican Party will be shedding itself before very long of its religious right politics and its anti-gay politics. And it is going to be competing to be more moderate and more tolerant. It's going to be going for those votes. So there may be, you know, when I say that progressives will dominate for the next generation to generation and a half, that doesn't mean that Democrats are going to win every election, although we are going to win the next one, two, or three elections overwhelmingly. That's in the book. That's, you can already take that to the bank. The Republicans are going to be moving to the middle, and they're going to be trying to reshape themselves, and some different things are going to happen, and the parties, both political parties, might reshape themselves with new names. We might have new political parties being birthed.
Interesting.
So it's going to be really interesting, but the same exact ideological two-party split that we have witnessed for the last 27 years, going back to 1980, is no longer going to be in existence. It's over, it's done, it's died, it's dead.
Yay, the revolution took a different look than what we thought it might. David, I do want to get your comments on Scooter Libby, but I do want to also just make a comment, because when you talk about those core values of this younger generation, I can't help but be struck by the fact that these are all things very much in line with feminism. And you know that I'm a big-time feminist. I'm president of the National Organization for Women in Texas, and those are all things that would be tenets of feminist belief. So that makes me feel very encouraged. Like, well, maybe we did get through, maybe we did do something right.
It just took a little time.
Well, you know, Deborah, and bless you, I consider myself a feminist as well. That's why I do anti-death penalty work. That's why, you know, my previous job was with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. You know, there are values that you and I embrace that I think the younger millennials are embracing as well. And it's going to show up. You know what? After 2008, 2010, we are going to see close to half the states in this country rushing to pass same-sex marriage laws.
Wow.
It's going to happen very, very quickly.
Wow.
I better find a girlfriend.
Yes,
quick.
Right. Well, and there's one other thing I want to bring up, is that there's a possibility of a nomination for Surgeon General, James Hollinger, who is, as Texas Equality says, Equality Texas says, is dangerous to your health. And he has been on record of his support for the cure for homosexuality. And if this person's going to be the Attorney General, we're in a lot of trouble.
Well, you know, about that nomination, Jack, for Surgeon General, I've got three letters for you. D-O-A.
Well, I hope so.
Dead on arrival.
And speaking of health, I really recommend going out and seeing the movie Sicko.
Saw it weekend before last.
Isn't it a great movie?
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Well, let's do our little bit on Scooter. What's your assessment on that before we tell you goodnight for...
Well, you know, Deborah, it's interesting that you ask that, because I have... one paragraph that I'd like to read you, if I may.
Sure.
From an op-ed piece that was written by a good friend of mine named David Dow. And this op-ed piece appeared in the Houston Chronicle, I think it was yesterday. David Dow is the head of the Innocence Project in Texas, a law professor, represents people on death row.
Right.
Death row. Here's what he says. Lewis Libby had something in common with the other people George Bush has pardoned, and with people President Clinton pardoned as well. He is rich and powerful, and he has rich and powerful connections. People do not get pardons because they are mentally retarded, or because they were young when they committed their crime, or because they had terrible lawyers, or because they have reformed, or even because they are innocent. They get them because they have friends in high places. That might not be illegal, but it's still wrong. And a president who issues pardons and commutations on that basis has not done very much at all to bring integrity to the Oval office.
Well, and if you also, another really good column is Frank Rich's column on Sunday in the New York Times. He talks about the cowardness of Bush, that they did this, you know, right before the 4th of July when the news cycle is not really happening, and that, you know, he talks in front of, well, of course we know this, he only talks in front of the groups that he pretty much has control over that support him, that he'd never be out in public and talk to, you know, a general cross-representation of the population.
Well, you're right, Jack, but I mean, to use the words cowardice and Bush in the same sentence is just simply redundant.
You're right.
What I loved was when he said, well, because he just decided that it was, you know, the too stiff of a penalty, you know, because he is the decider and all that. There's a group here in Houston, Road Women, the River Oaks area Democratic women, and they sent out a message called Chronic Outrage Fatigue. And you just hear those words and you know exactly what they're talking about, because it seems like it's one thing after another. And when the news came that Bush had commuted Libby's sentence, it was just like, how much more is he going to pull, and how much more are we going to take? And there is some movement for impeachment at this time. I don't know if that'll happen, but there certainly are people that are talking impeachment of both Bush and Cheney, because you can't do one without the other.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Well, anything else you want to leave us with, David Elliott?
Just that, an antidote for, being disgusted and tired and having fatigue for everything that is going on, an antidote for that is getting out and voting and doing volunteer work.
Yes.
And things that are good for yourself and for your community.
Yes, yes. And, David, thank you. What is your day job again?
Well, Jack, thanks. I'm the communications director for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. You can see our website at www.ncadp.org. Again, that's ncadp.org.
And David Elliott joins us usually the first Monday of the month and gives us a report that Deborah has titled Inside the Beltway and Beyond Report. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 7th, 2007. Rights for sexual minorities are part of Thailand's proposed new constitution. Along with the guarantee of equal rights for men and women, the 100-member drafting council voted unanimously this week for a constitutional reference to those of other sexual identities. The council had earlier rejected a proposal to more specifically guarantee LGBT rights, fearing that it would create a legal third sex. But the country's queer advocacy groups say the language as proposed still protects their constituencies. The current Thai government was installed by a bloodless military coup in September 2006. The country has long had the reputation of being very tolerant of sexual minorities, but societal attitudes remain deeply conservative in the predominantly Buddhist nation. Thailand's voters are expected to consider the new constitution in a first-ever national referendum in August. If the document, as drafted, wins approval, Thailand would join a handful of countries, most notably South Africa, to specifically protect gays and lesbians in its national constitution. The announced inclusion was followed the next day by calls from equality advocates for a boycott of a Bangkok nightclub run by European hotel chain Novotel after bouncers refused entry to a male crossdresser. The boycott was called off after the club quickly issued a public apology.
Not getting an apology was Malaysia's former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim. He filed a defamation lawsuit against former Prime Minister Mahathir bin Mohamad for calling him a homosexual. A High Court judge rejected the suit this week, ruling that it was unsustainable because the court had dismissed a similar libel action in 1999. The former finance minister and Mahathir's then heir apparent was first accused of being gay in 1998 by the prime minister, who fired Anwar from the cabinet for challenging his authority. The two had a falling out at the time over policies addressing the financial downturn in Asia. Anwar was subsequently convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison for sodomy and corruption in a trial that critics accused Mahathir of manufacturing to derail his former deputy's political ascent. Anwar was released in September 2004 after the sodomy conviction was overturned, but the corruption verdict bars him from running for public office until April 2008. Mahathir, who has since retired after 22 years in power, continued to defend his actions. "Imagine having a gay prime minister," he told reporters in September 2005. "Nobody would be safe." That prompted Anwar to file his second defamation lawsuit. His lawyer said he would appeal this week's ruling.
Meanwhile, Gabor Zete has become the first Hungarian cabinet minister to come out as a gay man. The Socialist Party member and resource secretary in the coalition government used a speech opening an LGBT film festival to make his announcement, saying that it had taken him 28 years to come to terms with his homosexuality, and that it was something he couldn't discuss with his now deceased mother. "I believe in God, love, freedom, and equality," he said. "I am Hungarian and European. I am a partner, a friend, sometimes an opponent, and I am gay." Zete is the second politician to come out in Hungary. The first was Klára Ungár, an MP from the Alliance of Free Democrats, one of the partners in the coalition government. Her party has called for passage of a bill extending all the rights of marriage to same-gender couples. Socialists heading up the government, however, are deeply divided on the issue. The bill is similar to Britain's civil partnerships, but specifically forbids the use of the word marriage to describe those relationships. The opposition Christian Democratic People's Party opposes the bill. Zete's declaration came on the eve of the Budapest Pride Parade. The right-wing Movement for a Free Hungary called the march an offense to public morality.
But an estimated 2.5 million people from across Europe gathered in Madrid this week for the annual EuroPride Festival. The changing locale of the event, scheduled for Stockholm in 2008, gave LGBT activists the chance this year to salute Spain's socialist government for passing marriage equality legislation, turning the once deeply conservative Roman Catholic nation into a bastion of equality. The four-day festival, featuring about 200 cultural and sporting events, was capped by the EuroPride parade on June 30th, with 45 festive floats, some from as far away as Manchester, Marseille, Stockholm, and Zurich. The parade crisscrossed Madrid under the banner, "Now Europe, Equality is Possible." Several groups carried banners saying, "For a European Union free of discrimination," and "Watch out for the German Shepherd," next to a photograph of outspokenly anti-queer Pope Benedict XVI. LGBT activists draped in rainbow flags also demonstrated in front of the Polish embassy, calling on the conservative government there to reverse its increasingly repressive policies against the country's sexual minorities.
Radio Netherlands reported that about 50,000 people attended the annual Pride celebration this week in the southern Dutch city of Bergen op Zoom. Deputy Defense Minister Cees van der Knaap and two generals accompanied 15 openly gay soldiers in the parade, the first time members of the military have marched in that event in uniform.
Four people from a conservative evangelical group from Georgia were arrested on June 30th at the Pride celebration in St. Petersburg, Florida, after they violated a city order restricting their protest demonstrations to a free speech zone a block from the festival. According to a report on the 365gay.com website, they held signs reading "Sodomy, It's to Die For," and "Adam and Eve, Not Adam and Steve," while others used a bullhorn to denounce Pride participants. The loud music from the festival virtually drowned out the protesters. Police said about 40,000 people attended the celebration, although organizers said it was closer to 60,000. People attending the festival largely ignored the demonstrators, though some blew kisses at them.
In other news this week, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America has removed Atlanta, Georgia pastor Bradley Schmeling from the church's pastoral roles because he's an out and partnered gay man. The denomination allows openly gay clergy as long as they're celibate. Last year, when Schmeling announced that he had a gay partner, his bishop asked the pastor to resign. When Schmeling refused, the bishop started the disciplinary proceedings. But Schmeling says he won't leave the pulpit of St. John's Lutheran Church, and his congregation supports him. That could open the 350-member congregation to disciplinary action by the church.
But Toronto area Metropolitan Community Church Reverend Brent Hawks, who led the charge to marriage equality in the country, was named this week to the Order of Canada. It's the highest civilian honor there, awarded in the name of the Queen by the Governor General, her representative in the country. Hawks sparked the eventual move to marriage equality in the country in 2001 by suing the Ontario government after the province refused to register the marriages he performed at the predominantly LGBT church for two same-gender couples. Hawks said he was surprised by the honor, telling the Globe and Mail newspaper, "I'm used to picketing governments."
And 2 weeks after the Anglican Church of Canada voted to maintain its ban on same-gender blessings, a pair of renegade parishes are publicly vowing to bless and even marry gay and lesbian couples. Clergy at Holy Trinity Church in downtown Toronto, Ontario, and at St. Saviour's Church in Victoria, British Columbia, have each declared their intention to conduct blessing ceremonies. And we're not the only ones, Jim Ferry, one of the priests at Holy Trinity, told the Can West News Service this week. There are similar parishes in the major urban centers, he said, wherever there's a significant population of gay and lesbian people. Bishops have the authority to fire priests if they defy rules of the national church. The thing to remember is that in Canada, same-sex marriage is now the law of the land, said Ferry. We have that reality to deal with here. At stake for Anglicans is the unity of one of Canada's largest churches, and also the survival of the 77 million member Global Anglican Communion. The loose affiliation of national churches has been at the brink of schism for months because of serious differences over sexual morality and biblical interpretation between progressive North American Anglicans and more traditional adherents in Africa, Asia, and Latin America.
Meanwhile, Anglican spiritual leader and Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, may be reconsidering his refusal to invite controversial openly gay New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop V. Gene Robinson to the Lambeth Conference, a once-a-decade global gathering of Anglican bishops. According to a story in London's Times, Robinson would reportedly attend but not be able to vote at the conference, scheduled for next July in Canterbury, England. Williams has also been under fire by Nigerian Archbishop Peter Akinola for not inviting the leader of a group of conservative Episcopal congregations that have defected to the African prelate's governance because of the U.S. Anglican wing's consecration of Robinson and support for same-gender blessings. In yet another sign that a schism seems inevitable, the outspokenly homophobic head of Anglicanism's fastest-growing regional branch, with about 20 million members, announced this week that he and his Nigerian bishops plan to boycott the Lambeth Conference.
But finally, Turkish equality activists are defiantly speaking out following mid-June raids on two gay bars in Istanbul. According to the Commission for Monitoring Human Rights of LGBTT Persons and Law, a coalition of several Turkish queer organizations, police threatened to use pepper spray and billy clubs as they herded patrons into the streets. When some of the patrons ignored orders to disperse and instead began clapping, they were clubbed. The same officers, the commission said, then went hunting for gay and transgender people nearby and assaulted several. The commission demanded that the city's public prosecutor and mayor and Turkey's parliament and prime minister investigate, search, and monitor the human rights violations against LGBTT persons, saying that we will not be quiet against being prevented from our basic rights of being human.
And that's News Wrap for the week ending July 7th, 2007. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
This is Queer Voices.
My voice on the come on, and the sweat will pour down, and when the disco glows. shows that we can really go to town.
I'm looking for someone to really fit the lid. Someone for the long run, maybe we can raise a kid. Till I find a boyfriend, I'll be singing in the band. Weekends I'll have.
My boy's on the
a kiss is still a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. These fundamental things apply, gay, straight, or bi. Gay, straight, or bi.
Now would it really scare us if Hanks could kiss Banderas just once before he dies?
Let's hope that's what the future brings as time goes by,
as time goes by.
Kisses Laura Dern and networks celebrate.
Tom Selleck kisses Kevin Klein, no need to prove he's straight.
Richard Simmons gets a man,
and Dykes with kids can date.
Two moms and apple pie.
I'd like to wake one morning without parental warning as Bert and Ernie kiss goodbye. The world may someday welcome lovers.
Gay, straight, or bi.
Kinsey Six, Straight, Gay, or Bi, from 1999. And before that, Clark Carlton, Boys on the Sand, from the album Salt Water. This is Queer Voices.
Jack just points to me like, okay, I'm supposed to talk about something. Well,
you've never been at a loss for words.
I know. It seldom happens because I just make stuff up if I don't know anything. Well, I got the announcement today of the new season for the Bayou City Performing Arts. Their 2007-2008 concert season is called Echoes. And it's first of all, they're going to have a special benefit concert on October 23rd. At Jones Hall, it'll be the combined choruses, and it is a benefit for the Susan B. Komen for the Cure organization, and it's a really good thing for our community to be doing something that can have an impact on something as serious as breast cancer. It's called Sing for the Cure, and it's a unique musical experience of eight women's journeys through breast cancer, and the piece features chorus, orchestra, and narration, and so they have special pricing on tickets and all that, and if you order your season tickets by October 1st, you're guaranteed to get the seats that you had last year, or you can go ahead and try to upgrade. And then the Echoes will have a holiday concert, Ho 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 Down to Hollywood, which I don't understand.
I don't either.
Echoes of the Season. And then that's going to be Tuesday, December the 8th at Jones Hall at 7:30. totally awesome echoes of the 80s. Now, that's more like it. That one I can get. That'll be the Gay Men's Chorus at Jones Hall on March 31st of 2008.
Some people mark your calendar.
Yeah, some people plan ahead, Jack.
In arts like this, people do plan ahead. They buy these tickets well in advance. And I didn't go to the last concert, but I heard it was really
It was wonderful. It was the tribute to Judy Garland, part of the Pride celebration. It was great. Strength and Solidarity, Echo of Women, will be a 1940s smash hit review by the Bayou City Women's Chorus, and that will be on Saturday, May 17th and Tuesday, May 20th at Bering Memorial United Methodist Church at 7:30. And then they'll close out the season in June with their Pride concert, Metamorphosis, Echoes of the Voyage, and they will create a multi-dimensional sensory art experience. So I don't know what that's going to be, but that sounds pretty remarkable. Metamorphosis. And of course, you can find out more at the website www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org.
And if you didn't have enough Pride, or you weren't happy with the way Pride turned out this year, tomorrow is the production team meeting, where basically that's the chairs of the different committee, like the Parade Committee and the Festival Committee. They're having a meeting at 7 p.m. at 1415 California on the first floor, and the door's on the left side of the building when you look at the building from the street. And then this Saturday at 11 a.m. is the board meeting, and that starts at 11 a.m. at the same place, 1415 California.
And those are open to anyone who's interested in them?
I believe they are open to anybody who is interested. Board meetings are supposed to be public, I understand, for nonprofits, but that's not always the case.
And the production meeting, that's a chance for people to say, okay, these are the things that we had problems with, these are the things that
I'm not exactly sure if that's the topic that's going to be brought up. I'm sure there will be some review of what happened during the year. Generally, or at least in the past, there used to be like these open meetings where people can come and make comments, and I'm not sure whether that's specifically open tomorrow for the public. There's supposed to be a community feedback meeting, which in August sometime, and the place has not been they haven't announced the place of the meeting. It is my understanding that they are not going to consider moving the parade next year.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about what's going on.
Well, and I don't know any of the official word. I haven't gotten the official
But their two employees were let go, and they reported a deficit. They said the festival was a failure. They blamed it on the weather.
Well, it really had to be more than the weather.
Well, not only that, I mean, because actually I was surprised by the number of people that were there considering the weather, but besides that, I mean, if you have an event like that and you have an auxiliary event, you can't base your make or break it point on the auxiliary event.
Well, you know, I mean, this brings up the whole topic of community and nonprofit organizations. I mean, in reality, most of them are just, well, most people basically are living one paycheck, you know, to financial doom. And a lot of nonprofits are, unfortunately, in that state that they're trying to provide their services and they're trying to do things. And they don't really have a money in the bank to in case things
fail. But there are quite a few that do manage
and
well and do make sure that they don't spend more than they have.
And Pride
with
in the past.
Pride,
yeah, well,
and
I'm not
history.
With Pride this year.
Right.
So, although I was Grand Marshal, which was an incredible honor, and I really appreciated that. And Pride used to have the philosophy that the time the parade steps off, everything's been paid for. But my understanding is that didn't happen this year.
Yeah, and so the end result of what that will mean as far as preparing for the 2008 events and where the Pride Committee, if it's going to be able to stay solvent enough to continue, if a new group will have to form, or exactly what's going to, rumor already has it that they're dropping the whole issue of moving the parade, which
at least for this year.
We had planned to have a special on July 30th to discuss the pros and cons of that, because there's some of us that are passionate about it not moving out of Montrose,
right.
And then other people that, very much think that it should.
Well, and there's a couple other things. I mean, the fact that the communications from Pride Houston has not been the best this year. We have not, you know, gotten a press release in the past four, five, six months.
Although we did go out and you know, ask for Pride representation and tried to report on it the best we could, but we did not get any press releases.
And neither has some of the other community publications. And yes, there's the website, but basically the website just says everything's been a success, and we know that's not true. Definitely the crowds were down for the parade this year. And that's unfortunate. Part of it was probably because it rained earlier, but in reality it was a nicer night that night because it wasn't that hot out.
I'm not even sure if the success of the parade hinges on the numbers that come out to see
That's one of the one of the, you know, things that you look at.
And still the weather could have been a factor there too, because after it had rained all day, people might have thought, well, it's going to continue to rain, or I don't want to, you know, it's a mess, whatever. Well, as much rain as we get, Houstonians are kind of funny about it, about the rain.
Well, exactly. I mean, people, you know.
I don't like to go out when it's raining. I left my house the other day, and I got a block away, and I had to turn around.
Well, that might have been a real smart thing the other day when it was
raining
so and bad.
And that's in the Heights, in an area that, you know, doesn't normally get high water.
Well, Friday it did. It did rain a lot in that area of town. But so we don't know exactly what's going on, and this is all sort of, you know, I get some emails from people talking about this. If you really want to get involved, and, you know, the reality is organizations are only successful for two reasons. One is people raise money to do things, and two, people get involved and they're committed, and they work together with the community to try to move things. And, you know, we got to look at it. There's a number of organizations in the community that is, you know, on the edge of sort of falling apart, and it's really sad. I mean, you know, we used to have the Empower event that used to happen downtown at George R. Brown. That doesn't happen anymore. Miss Camp America. And, you know, every community sort of does change and evolve. But, you know, now that I have Logo,
Logo Television?
Yeah, now. Logo Television. And I started watching In the Life because they're, you know, you can program it to record that. And there's like, you know, I really have never watched In the Life.
Oh, is it on a Logo?
Yes.
Okay, because it's on Channel 8, but
it's
at a weird time, like 1 a.m.
Yes,
on
once a quarter.
It was on at 1 a.m. this morning, I think.
Oh, well, and
which I didn't watch, nor did I record.
So, Logo's like playing back some of the older episodes, which is great.
Some excellent programs.
Yes. It is an incredibly good show, and one of them, they were talking about the GLBT community in Chicago on North Halsted Street, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was just incredible. The city put up these big sort of markers, sort of, you know, the type of thing that they have over in the Galleria area, although it's not the rings, it's something different, with a rainbow emblem on it that really designates the GLBT community, and that they're building, I believe it's a $20 million community center in Chicago, which is really, really
We got to find out, you know, how to tap into that, because they do it in other cities, and it has not happened in Houston. We have a community center, but it's struggling.
Yes, and part of it is leadership. It's leadership of organizations. It's dedication. It's easy to blame the community that they're not interested in doing things, but it takes leadership, people that raise money, people to be organized. And I mean, I did this for Pride for, you know, 25 years working, and, you know, I mean, I worked holidays, and it's not just me. There's lots of other people.
Well, you're a workaholic.
Yeah, and I'm crazy. I know that. But, I mean, not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before, you know, Monday was a holiday, the 26th, so we opened up the Pride office, and we had a couple volunteers show up. So, you know, it takes that. It's real easy to say, oh, the community isn't interested, but you got to sort of build that platform. I mean, you know, the political caucus now has sort of really grown, and I'm on the board, so I'm a little bit close to the situation, but it's a small board, but everybody is in there working together, and different people on the board have different specialties. And, you know, this is probably a show that we ought to do a segment on, about how boards are, you know, how organizations are put together, how they continue, how they, you know, find board members. In reality, a lot of people think, oh, it's just a status symbol to be on the board. It's, you know, for an organization to be successful, it takes work and dedication and a lot of sweat.
Well, the mantra for board members is they either give money or get money. That's their main function. But it really, a whole lot more goes into it.
In a smaller organization, it's also, you know, a lot of these boards are working boards that they sweat and you know, and there's all these, you know, you do have to have money and resources to do things, but you also have to volunteers. And even if you have a small staff, the staff can't. I mean, look at KPFT.
Right.
There's like 8-10 people on staff here, yet most of the programming is done by volunteers. And, you know, as a volunteer, we're very lucky that we come in the door and the lights are on, the transmitter's on, and the equipment pretty much works.
They tell us these microphones work and that people hear us.
Yes, yeah, supposedly, but we're here, so we wouldn't know. We know that. We know that it works. And, you know, and KPFT's been around since 1970, but it's a lot of volunteers.
And the volunteer listeners who volunteer by funding it.
Yes,
which is
exactly,
you know, continues to be a daily miracle.
Community radio.
That's exactly
and
right.
And so, you know, we do a lot of talking to people involved in the community organizations, and you know, and the community involves. You look at, and I just saw this movie the other night called The Lost Language of the Cranes.
Oh yes.
And
I remember that one.
I started to read the book years and years ago, and I believe the author is David Levitt, I think. And I never got through with it, but I finally rented the video and watched it, and it basically is about an English family, a mother, father, and son, and the son basically comes out, this is I think based in the 80s, the son comes out that he's gay, and in reality the father's been gay all his life, but he's not been living it because he just, in his culture when he was growing up, it was different. And you know, it's yes, things evolve, things change, it's a lot easier to come out now, and maybe some of the organizations that we had 20 years ago we may not need today, but you know, those foundation organizations, still there is some needs for those who don't feel as comfortable to come out today. And I was just reading this article today about the Advocate is now going to give you the option, if you're a subscriber via mail, of whether you need it packed in that white cover so that your mailman or your neighbors don't know that you're getting the
Advocate. I didn't even know they still did that.
Well, and years ago, certainly as we did bulk mail for the caucus, it always had to be in that white envelope, and you'd never put the word gay or lesbian on a return envelope. And, you know, nowadays we're doing that more and more, and yet there's still some people who complain about it, even if they have a P.O. box. So we have come a long way.
Well, you know, some of the fears of exposure, because remember, they used to, like, have a bar raid, and they
yes.
would list the people's names.
In the paper.
In addresses.
Yes.
In the newspaper.
Yes.
And that did cost people their families, their jobs, a lot. And things are very different since all these many years after Stonewall.
And, you know, it's still, you know, a concern for some people, but there's a lot more people that feel more comfortable about it. And, boy, we got off on a whole bunch of different stuff.
We sure did. Well, that's what happens when we talk about pride. It just takes us off.
Well, and you're right. I mean, pride has a lot. It's more than just one little part of the community. It's and especially in Houston.
It is the community.
It is the community. It's the one thing that brings everybody together every year, or more than any other event.
I mean, when you look at some of the delegations that are in the parade, because I was reviewing the lineup, and some people complained about the number of politicians, but I remember the days when we used to beg politicians to come
yes.
be in our parade, and
yes.
a lot of people took it as a sign of, you know, just what their level of support for our community is. We had the people that are for animal rights. We had the Great Peace Flag Group. We had the AIDS Foundation. It was such a diversity of groups and people and all those organizations that do make up our community. I guess that's one reason it means so much to me to see it thrive.
Yes.
And why I want us to have a solid foundation so that it can continue. And hopefully we will find out just exactly what's going on and come up with some solutions, because, you know, don't really go and complain about something unless you're willing to be part of the solution.
Right, right. Although some people got their plates full, and, you know, you expect an organization to do something and it just doesn't, and that's a concern. You're listening to KPFT, and I think we have more of This Way Out.
If you Peter Tchaikovsky, the first Russian composer to gain international fame, coming up now on Rainbow Minute. Even today, Tchaikovsky's symphonies, operas, and concertos are performed worldwide, but it is his ballets that have become world-renowned, like Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, and the perennial favorite, The Nutcracker. Born in the Russian Ural Mountains in 1840, he was not musically inclined as a child. But after a short civil service career, he entered the newly founded St. Petersburg Conservatory of Music and quickly matured as a composer. Several commissions from a wealthy widow made it possible for Tchaikovsky to devote all his time to composing. While some criticized his early works, his music was always popular with the public. His last symphony was dedicated to Vladimir Davidov, whom he described as incomparable, enchanting, and ideal. Upon Tchaikovsky's death, Vladimir was his sole heir. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Parker and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRAR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John Klein.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Are you signed up for our emailed This Way Out updates? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming program features and dishing some behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show. We also send out weekly email messages describing the specific content of each upcoming program. Just email tworadio@aol.com to get one or both of these messages delivered to your email inbox. And be assured that we don't share, sell, or otherwise provide your email address or anything else about you to anyone, and we never will. Again, to receive the occasional This Way Out updates and or our weekly program information messages, ask for one or both by name when you email tworadio@aol.com. The pitched antagonism between the LGBT civil rights movement and the religious right is a fixture in American politics today, but in the early 1970s, neither of them scored much of a blip on the public's radar screen. Thanks to pop singer Anita Bryant's 1977 Save Our Children campaign in Dade County, Florida, the religious right as a mobilized force was born, and queer street activism was born again. With the help of associate producer Lucia Chappell, This Way Out recalls those galvanizing moments in the LGBT struggle for equality.
This is a story about a huckster for Florida orange juice, the religious right in its infancy, and a politically naive and splintered queer community. It's also the story of how the battle for lesbian and gay equality in the United States was catapulted onto the national agenda.
The 1969 Stonewall Rebellion led to a flowering of new gay and lesbian organizations in several cities around the country. Among the early successes of the post-Stonewall movement were the passage of several local anti-discrimination laws. One such measure was introduced in late 1976 in Dade County, Florida, an area encompassing Miami, Miami Beach, and Coral Gables, and all nine Metro Dade commissioners voted to add sexual and affectional preference to the area's existing civil rights law. However, a second vote was required to finalize the ordinance, and the initial unanimous approval sparked an outcry from Christian fundamentalists. It is January 1977, as our story continues.
In Florida, the Dade County Commission gave its final approval to an ordinance which would prohibit discrimination against gays in the areas of housing, public accommodation, and employment, thus endorsing the concept of social and legal equality for Miami's homophile community. The commission, which had tentatively passed the controversial ordinance when it was first proposed in late December, voted 5-3 in favor after an emotional 2-hour public hearing in which opponents of the measure strongly voiced their objections. Among the opponents was singer Anita Bryant, who, like Pat Boone, is probably best known for her endorsement of Milk and the singing of hymns. Responding to the commission's pro-gay stand, Miss Bryant said, "We're not going to take this sitting down."
Flanked by a cluster of revivalists and her ever-present former disc jockey husband, Bob Green, Bryant kicked off her campaign by brandishing a pro-gay flyer and asserting that it had been distributed at a Coral Gables high school. An example of homosexual recruitment, she charged. Ridiculous, gay spokespersons responded. Bryant's rhetoric became increasingly strident, and so did the gay response to it, as a measure to repeal the anti-discrimination ordinance easily qualified for the June ballot.
Gay strategists decided to concentrate their resources on print and broadcast advertising, hyping constitutional concepts and American values. Relatively few people were out at the time, and there was little effort to put a human face on the issue, demonstrating the impact discrimination had on the real lives of gay men and lesbians. The area's large Cuban community was essentially ignored altogether by the pro-ordinance side.
As Election Day neared, two polls predicted that the repeal effort would fail. And this upbeat report from campaign strategist Bob Basker suggests that gays and lesbians faced the June 7th referendum with false optimism.
Here is a summary of what's been going on for the period ending May 10th, 1977. Now, our dear orange juice lady opponent has been shooting from the hip again. In an interview in this month's Miami Magazine, she stated that because a Southern California town had passed an ordinance similar to Miami's, God was punishing homosexuality because, as she said, now California is having the worst drought in history. And the reason why homosexuals are called fruits is because God says that men are trees and the new life is the fruit of the womb. Rod McEwen was in Miami last week working for the coalition. Mr. McEwen held a benefit concert for the coalition last Tuesday night.
Don't drink the orange juice, I beg you please. Don't drink the orange juice, I beg you please. Don't drink the orange juice, I beg you please. Not only to all kinds of bigotry.
The people of Dade County, the normal majority, have said enough, enough, enough.
Anita Bryant. June 7th was a thunderclap. The polls had aired embarrassingly as the rights ordinance was repealed by a better than 2-to-1 margin. Thousands of lesbians and gay men across the U.S. and around the world were shocked out of their closets. Protest demonstrations larger than any imaginable before took place in New York, Norfolk, Houston, New Orleans, Chicago, San Francisco, Salt Lake City, and many other places where a gay and lesbian demonstration would before have been unthinkable. In Los Angeles, 8,000 people held a candlelight march down Hollywood Boulevard.
This is Lucia Chappell. I'm talking to Frank Zerilli, one of the organizers of this demonstration. Frank, how many people do you think are here?
We have no idea, but it's larger than anything we've ever done in Los Angeles before, including the Christopher Street West Parade. It's unbelievable. 12 bars in town have closed, and the owners, many of the owners of them, are here. They're urging their customers to come to the demonstration.
We're getting ready to talk.
There's another group of marchers on the other side of the street. We're on the south side of Hollywood Boulevard. And there's another group on the north side of Hollywood Boulevard. This is quite a large demonstration tonight.
My sign says Turner Burn.
The thing that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so.
Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13.
We are walking on the north side of Sunset, and we just crossed Wilcox on the way back to DeLongpre Park, and the end of the line has not yet left Highland and Sunset, where the march started.
Human rights are here to stand. Be the right. Go away.
3, 5, 7, 9. Lesbians are mighty bomb.
We have reached DeLongpre Park, and there are still marchers waiting to begin at Hollywood High School.
Welcome to the first Los Angeles Gay Anxiety Workshop.
It doesn't look like the park is going to be nearly big enough to hold the number of people.
The events of last Tuesday in Dade County signaled the beginning of a national emergency. Not only for gay people, but for all people who dare to believe that there is still a constitution of the United States.
I remember an incident 4 years ago when I was walking through an amusement park holding hands with my lover and was called queer by a child 6 years old, and from that day forward I've been all too aware of who the child molesters in this society are.
Woo!
was walking down the street in on Miami Beach about 2 weeks ago, and somebody with a Kill a Queer for Christ bumper sticker, I was walking along with a brother, and they came over to us, and they stopped the car, and they rushed out of the car, and they said to Terry, you should take all of your homosexuals and put them on an island someplace. And Terry turned around and said, they did, darling, and they call it Manhattan.
Of scripture-quoting saints running around telling me how inferior I am. All my life that I'm inferior, first as a black, then as a woman, and now as a gay woman, and I am fed up.
It's time to say to Jimmy Carter and the National Democratic Administration that it's time to be for human rights abroad, but it's time to fight for gay rights at home.
I'd like to leave it with one final message, Anita, and that's if you can't take the fruit, get out of the orchard.
It was a crushing defeat for gays and lesbians, but the 1977 Dade County, Florida referendum unquestionably placed the issue of LGBT civil rights on the national, even the international, political agenda. When Anita Bryant cast her repressive shadow across the U.S. some three decades ago, lesbians and gay men rose up with scorning defiance. For both equality advocates and the religious right, it was the first skirmish in a war that continues to this day.
Save our children, give them strength. We will go to any length to keep our children's future. Is not enough. Guard our children, keep them strong. We must teach them right from wrong. Help protect our country's
start. We've got to play it rough. Give those kids a bed start, because 10% is not enough.
Love our children, love them now. Help them make a lifelong vow. Without cause.
enough. Chin up, returners, give your all. Help out at nursery school, you'll have more ball. To help out at the daycare store, it's really not that tough. Make them into gay kids because 10% is not enough.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Rick Swachner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with John Klein contributed program material. Rod McEwen, Mary Watkins, Tom Wilson-Weinberg, and Anita Bryant performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. You can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also get there by clicking on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by tax-deductible donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly programs there. To request a CD or cassette copy of this week's program, email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KAZU Pacific Grove, California, 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, WRUW Cleveland, Ohio, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. And so, Jack, I was thinking that, you know, it would be lovely if we had a volunteer available who could do web pages for us.
Yes, you know, we've had a couple bites on that, but I must scare people away. And of course, you know, I want something that looks... In fact, as you just bring that up, there's a web page called Arts Hound, as in hound dog, .com and probably .org. And it is a wonderful calendar for arts that happen in Houston. And you go to the page, and it opens up with a selections for theater, music, dance, and art. And then you can actually, and there's like a tab for festivals, for film, and of course it's not like the commercial things, but it's the things that... at the you know, museums and stuff like that. And it is an incredible calendar that is incredibly comprehensive. It has things about museums and public art and special events, and really just an encompassing thing for anything that's going on arts-wise in
so
in
personally
Houston.
Recommended by Jack Belinsky.
Yes, well, and my friend Veronica from Revels told me about it, and I'm just like blown away on how well this is put together.
Well, back to the web page for Queer Voices, we do need someone to help us create that, keep it, maintain, update information. It'd be very helpful because we would like to have that. You know, it's really hard to keep up with everything, and it gives us a presence that would be really nice for us to have.
Well, and ideally, we'd have somebody who knows things like cascading style sheets, so that
it doesn't have to be fancy.
Well, it needs to be set up so that it's easy to update.
Right. There's a lot of websites I go to, and they're just too busy. They just
yes.
have too many things.
Well, and I'm not looking for when you like the Chicago Pride website, where you open it up and it's got the gay flags, you know, waving, you know, and music. Oh yeah, you know, you open up, you know, and that's the one thing about GLBT web pages. A lot of people open it up at their desk at work, and that's the last thing they need to do is have It's Raining Men, you know,
and blaring
right.
music and all
right.
kinds of bells and whistles. So we'll make the job easy for you by trying to provide you with the information and give people a chance they can see playlists and, you know, have links to JD's Queer Music Heritage and do some of the things that we talk about. Then we could post up there so people would have that as a resource as well. So that would be really good. And so how do they get in touch with us? Jack@queervoices.org?
That would be good.
Okay. If you're interested in helping us with web pages, or if you're interested in perhaps getting involved in production of Queer Voices. If you'd like to learn how to run the board, which is something that we always need some backup for that, or if you have some information or skills, you always wanted to be a radio announcer, you can come on and maybe have a chance to do that. The KPFT,
right, maybe teach us how to do something.
Yeah, really. KPFT does provide training, and there's other volunteer opportunities at the station, and you can call and ask for Eddie, and you know, I don't know Eddie's last name, but he's the volunteer coordinator, and
oh,
he's a lovely guy, and he'll be glad to set you up. Or Ernesto Aguilar, the
program director.
I sort of say production director. I knew it wasn't right. Program director. And they'll be glad to talk to you about how you can get involved in radio right here in Houston. And you too can be a volunteer and not get paid for doing radio.
Right.
Just like Jack Belinsky and Deborah Bell and Glenn Holt. One of the things coming up in the community that would be on that arts calendar that you were talking about is the Alley Theater's Summer Chills program. And the Alley does this in the summer. They have mystery stories that they present, and it's a chance to go on the humid evening and enjoy a nice cool evening at the theater. But they've never done the Act Out program as part of the Summer Chills, so this is the first time. And on Thursday, July 19th, from 6 to 7:15 at the Alley Theater Production Center, which overlooks downtown Houston. There's a lovely reception. They have DJ Mike Bell and food from Hunan downtown, so you get free food and drink at the reception, and then you go down with the other folks and enjoy the play. And the play for this time is Death on the Nile, which is one of Agatha Christie's works. And these events are great fun. They always have a special drink. When they had To Kill a Mockingbird as the play, they had Tequila Mockingbird as the drink. So this time they have Denial as the specialty drink. I don't know what's in it, but you know, if you come to Act Out, you'll find out. And Act Out patrons can purchase tickets online at www.alleytheater.org, and you enter the promotional code Act Out. You can also purchase by phone, 713-220-5700. And if you want to know more about the play, A Steamer Travels Up the Nile. The eccentric passengers find themselves embroiled in the murder of a young, wealthy bride. Classic Christie, the suspenseful story keeps you guessing until the finish. And it will be running for 3 weeks at the Alley Theater, but you would probably be interested in attending on the Act Out night, because that's a chance to enjoy with other GLBT theater fans. And I always enjoy those evenings. The folks over there do great work. So, what else is going on?
Well, Jack, do you want to introduce this piece as something about pride and resistance?
Well, part of the Pacifica Queer Programmers got together, and typical Pacifica, not being organized, put together this 3-hour special, and it ran on some of the stations on either Saturday or Sunday or Pride, and but some of the other stations do not have GLBT programming weekly. So KPFT played the first hour, I think, the week right after Pride, but we didn't really know it or were able to promote it. So this is one of the things that didn't quite make the 3 hours. So we're going to play it now, but in coming weeks we're going to play Peace. No, actually, this is one of the things
this is
that...
We don't have time for the whole of the first hour, but we're going to play as much of it as we can.
And we should just say that contrary to the announcements that we made earlier, there's apparently been some...
Some of us didn't do our homework as well as we should have.
Yes, and I wonder who that was. But anyway, some snafus have occurred, and so we won't have Jeff Reed or Dalton D. Hart tonight, but hopefully in the near future they can join us.
We'll be right back. Welcome to Pride and Resistance, Pacifica Radio's special national programming for Pride 2007. I'm Vivian Marie Varela.
And I'm William Walker.
We have an amazing array of queer culture, critique, and chronology for your listening advancement today. And by advancement, we're talking about LGBT progress.
We're not talking about marriage, we're not talking about don't ask, don't tell, and we're not talking about will and grace. Not that these areas don't interest us, but they get a lot of play in the mainstream media.
We want to present queer stories that you don't hear every day. Real stories about real ideas and culture for real people like you and me. And that is what I love about Pacifica Radio. So in this hour, we're going to talk about gay gentrification, and we're going to hear about what it's like to be in your body if you're a transgender person. But first,
we'll take a look at the emergence of gay culture in LA at the beginning of the 20th century from my own co-host, Vivian Marie, of the IMRU radio program at KPFK Los Angeles.
So stay with us.
Author Daniel Hurwitz has uncovered what life was like at the turn of the 20th century in a hilly enclave near downtown Los Angeles called Edendale, now known as the neighborhoods of Silver Lake and Echo Park. It's the story of how the personal first became political and how the modern-day gay movement emerged in Los Angeles, influenced by the social culture of that time. And now, Vivian Marie of radio program IMRU at KPFK in Los Angeles speaks with author Daniel Hurwitz about his book, Bohemian Los Angeles and the Making of Modern Politics.
I love your book.
You're very sweet.
How did you get started writing this book?
Well, this book began as a tiny research project when I was a graduate student at UCLA. I was curious to learn a little bit more about the history of the Madison Society, the first real gay rights organization in the country, and it started here in LA in 1950, started largely by a man named Harry Hay. And I was curious to find out a little bit more about him and the organization. When I began the research, I thought, well, this organization came out of a neighborhood, Silver Lake, here in LA. Let me go over there and see what if I can find out what was going on. I started asking questions about Harry Hay, and I started hearing stories that seemed completely unrelated about this rich bohemian world. And I was intrigued, and so I started digging in to find out more about it.
You really put him in the proper context in your book, and that's what I love about it. But you start out with another man named Julian Elting.
Yes. It's funny. In fact, I was doing pretty much my first interview with someone from the neighborhood. I didn't know how to do an interview. I didn't know how to ask questions or even run the tape recorder. But I thought, here's someone who's going to tell me a little bit about Silver Lake. At some point in the interview, this gentleman mentioned to me Julian Elting. Julian Elting, it turns out, at the turn of the century in the 1900s, was one of the great vaudeville stars of the country. In fact, he was celebrated not only in the country, he was celebrated around the world. He and his producers built a theater on 42nd Street in the heart of New York City's theater district that was called the Elting Theater. He was that important. And he was brought out by film studios to become an early silent film star. The surprise about Julian Elting, given that he was such a star, is that his talent and his whole career was being a female impersonator. So at the turn of the 20th century, a female impersonator was a national star. Well, already when I heard that, you know, I sat right up like, what are you talking about? We think maybe drag queens, maybe RuPaul has broken new ground at the end of the 20th century. But in fact, America was such a different place 100 years ago in a way we couldn't imagine. And so digging into Julian's story began to open up for me this lost world in which the way people acted and were understood was very different from our own time.
You brought out his story and how he was so famous, but he really didn't want people to consider him as, I don't even know if they had a word for someone who had a relationship with another person of the same sex.
Right, that was one of the things that's fascinating about learning about Julian, is in some ways Julian is in a class by himself, right? He's a superstar. In other terms, the way he was like many Americans was that many American men certainly had sex and emotional relationships with other men at the turn of the century without saying, well, this is a central feature of who I am. We talk today about someone being gay, and when we say someone's gay, we feel like we've said something fundamental about them. This is part of their character. This is a central piece of their identity. At the turn of the century, Julian and others didn't think about their sex lives or their emotional lives in those terms. He had sex, he fell in love, whatever, but his identity was wrapped up in other issues. So part of the transition that I then was excited to try to understand was, well, then how did we get to a time when someone like Harry Hay says, the fact that I have sex with other men means I'm gay, and it means I need to fight a political battle to protect my rights.
What is exciting to me, when you studied Edendale, I was like, where is Edendale? So I took a drive down Sunset Boulevard, and I saw there's a library that says Edendale, yes, Public Library,
yes,
or whatever.
There's a post office also that's still the Edendale post office right there on Glendale.
Yeah, and so then I started getting more of a feel for where we were at and where Edendale was.
I love that name, Edendale. You know, it's a name that quickly sort of disappeared in the history of Los Angeles, but now what we call Silver Lake and Echo Park is the neighborhood that once had this poetic name of Edendale. And I love it just because it's so evocative, telling the story of a time and an era that has slipped away from us.
You do mention prohibition in your book. What do you think about what effect it had on society? Because from prohibition, things started going underground.
Yes. In some ways, people make the argument, which I think is quite interesting, that if you wanted to drink during prohibition, you had to break the law. And once you took that step of saying, okay, this law, this government that tells me I shouldn't be drinking, I'm ignoring them. Once you took that step and said, what's beyond the pale? Suddenly, you found Americans willing to explore a host of things. One of the things from the perspective of gay history that's interesting is that in the last stages of prohibition in the early 1930s, you saw in cities around the country, here in LA, but also in New York, Chicago, elsewhere, you saw female impersonators, drag performers, being celebrated in the nightclubs of the cities. They were the hosts, they were the MCs at clubs. There was what one historian calls a pansy craze for these kind of performers. So prohibition, from the perspective of gay history, opened a door for the average middle-class American to discover a world that they wouldn't have discovered otherwise.
You know, it feels like we're going backwards.
It's true. I mean, what's interesting when you study gay history and you see someone like Julian Elting, who we were talking about, or these pansy performers in the early 1930s being celebrated, you realize, wait a second, the kind of oppression that I thought had always occurred for gay people, that homosexually active men and women have always been put down. In fact, that's not true. That 100 years ago, performers like Julian Elting were celebrated. But something happened there in the late 1930s, 40s, and 50s in which a system of oppression was built into the laws and police started to entrap gay men and women. And I think you're right that it feels like we're moving back to those years again. A change, though, as you point out, is the emphasis on religion here at the start of the 21st century. In the 30s, 40s, and 50s, gay men and women were not pursued because of religious questions or moral values. They were seen as a threat to society, but they were seen as a threat like communists were. Someone who was going to eat away and challenge the social system. Now we see gay men and women talked about as a threat to families and a threat to moral values, and that is a big change for us. But I do think maybe there are lessons to learn from how these attacks operate in the middle of the century as we think about how to deal with the attacks that are going on now.
What are the lessons?
Well, I think the clearest lesson is that two positive things happened as the police and legislators moved against homosexually active men and women in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Certainly, a lot of negative things happened. Men were incarcerated for incredible periods of time. You could be arrested in California for one act of same-sex activity, could land you in prison in San Quentin for 5 years.
Yes,
more than
terrible.
One act, 10, 15, 20 years. So terrible things happen, and if you weren't imprisoned, if you weren't sent to prison, maybe you were sent to a mental hospital where you were only released when the staff decided you were cured.
Right.
And being cured by the staff at a mental hospital could involve electroshock therapy,
right.
It could involve surgery, from castration to lobotomy, all sorts of terrible things happened. What happened positively, though, I think in that period, was that homosexually active men and women developed an underground subculture for themselves in which they continued to find one another and figured out ways to communicate, to contact one another, to have parties or get-togethers that were below the radar of the police. But secondly, and I think more important, was that Mattachine and gay rights organizations like Mattachine formed to challenge this oppressive regime. So I think the lesson for us, that maybe the most important lesson for us that we see from this period to apply to our own period, is that we can and need to act in concert, organize to form a response. And if we do that, if we put our energies into responding and defending our rights and our privileges, we can succeed. Because Harry Hay and the Mattachine Society ultimately succeeded. When you look around at the West Hollywoods or the gay rights that so many Americans cherish now, it's because of what organized activists like Harry Hay did in reaction to this kind of oppression. We can do the same thing. We have to.
We have to. Let's talk a little bit about aging. When did you meet Harry?
I can't remember the year off the top of my head, but it was in the last few years of his life. I met him at an event once, I spoke to him on the phone, and then the next time I saw him, he was in the hospital. And I interviewed him one or two times again after that, but I remember very clearly sitting with him in the hospital at the, you know, in the last couple of years of his life, he had a respirator on, he couldn't talk to me. I just sat and held his hand.
And what did you think as you were sitting there?
Well, aging fools us, I think. You know, you sit and you hold hands with an old person and you think, my, they're frail. Or you think, gosh, I wonder how long they have left. And you forget that this person did something powerful in their lives. They were once young and strong. And Harry Hay, when he was active in Los Angeles, was performing street theater around the city. He was chaining himself to the gates of UCLA in resistance. He was active organizing communists and later organizing gay men and women. And aging fools us into forgetting that. We forget the fights that people engaged in. And so sitting with Harry was interesting because I saw that, because I knew his story. I knew how dynamic he had been, that it made me think about how aging erases that, and I need to resist that. I need to go back and find the story of what these people accomplished when they were young and vibrant and fighting.
I think this is the charge that we have to ourselves, to go back and look at our history. And I think you have brought it out beautifully in your book. And I want to challenge every person listening and every person who is less than 50 years old to go back and read about your history or about the history of, read this book, Bohemian Los Angeles and the Making of Modern Politics by Daniel Hurwitz. It's sad that we age because that's part of our human condition. But I think going back to community, because when I saw Harry, I visited him in his home. It would have been great if a few of us could have gotten together and helped him with some everyday chores, like washing the dishes or sweeping the floor or something like that, just to help him make his life more comfortable. Because anyone who pursues their artistic and creative desires isn't necessarily going to have the money to support that. And Harry didn't. But he continued his life. He kept on living, even though no one was really paying attention to him. But he kept on living, and that gave you a chance to meet him. It gave me a chance to meet him.
Yeah, I would say, in addition to your charge to your listeners, I think there are people around us who are full of inspiration for us, who are full of stories to tell us. We just have to ask them. I feel so lucky to have met the people who are in the pages of my book and some who aren't in there, because the stories they told me inspire me. I'm inspired by the courage that they had, and they are 80 and 90 years old, and nonetheless, they have lived lives of great significance. You wouldn't know it if you didn't ask them, but once you open the door and ask the question, you can't believe what you'll hear.
Exactly. That's what I love about your book, because it inspires me to think that we can do something better and we can help each other. We just have to find like souls who are willing to say, okay, I am willing. You're my friend. You've known me for the past 5 years. You know what my creative aspirations are. How can we work together as a team? People in other cultures do the very same thing. Folks who took care of Paul Landacre for that purpose, to foster the creativity that we have in each other and not put it down and not push it to the side or ignore it. But say, what are your creative aspirations? What do you want to do? How do you think you can make a difference in your community? I think that is one of the inspiring things that I love about your book. Who was Cyril Gerber?
Cyril Gerber was one of these communists that I met in the last few years of his life. He was a school teacher who lived in a cooperative housing unit or complex that was built in the late 40s, where 10 leftist families got together. This is before condos existed as even a concept, and said, we can jointly buy property, build a building here, and have a shared home life. We'll all have our own apartment units, but we can jointly take care of this. Gerber was in these Avenel co-ops, and he was a school teacher who was also active in the left as an organizer, and ultimately lost his job when he was called before the Senate committee investigating communist activity here in Los Angeles. He'd had a successful career at that point as a teacher and ended up spending a few years working odd jobs, groceries, what have you, just to make ends meet to support himself and his wife and two children.
This is what scares me, and that is that people had this scare about communism, and then they got so scared and concerned about their own lives that they would turn people in.
Yes.
And testify against them, which, you know, that whole McCarthy, the McCarthy thing. Now, that could happen with religious zealots. Or they could say, I'm not discounting that it could happen. They could say, oh, I know a gay person. They live over there on that street. See that house right there? They're gay. Or anything. Or they're, you know, she's Latina or whatever. They could say that.
I think it's true, although I think I'm less pessimistic maybe than you are. Because I think that, you know, when you think about the election of Bill Clinton,
mm-hmm.
which was, what, a dozen years ago now?
Yeah.
More than that. He sought out the gay vote. Now, we can criticize what he did once in office to prove his worth to gay voters. But the fact that American politicians at the presidential level see gay people as having potential political power says to me that when the religious zealots say, turn in their names, turn in these people, there are going to still be politicians who say, well, wait a second, they also are a powerful force in the country. I think that's one of the things we've earned in the last 50 years, is some recognition of our political power. It's still up in the air what we will do with that power, but I still feel like we're not quite as vulnerable as you make us out to be.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm naive.
No, I hope not. people do things to get on the bandwagon of whoever's providing any kind of economic security or any kind of security, emotional or whatever, political.
I do think the one thing I think about that is that I would love to see gay people join a cause in which we were advocating for the protection of American civil liberties and criticizing and condemning people who sought to undermine civil liberties. I'd rather see the extreme right and the religious zealots put on the defensive the way they've put us on the defensive and make them appear to be un-American. That's the campaign I think it's worth gay people getting involved in.
That would be great. Daniel, you've written a wonderful book. You wrote a great epilogue as well.
Thank you.
What is your hope in writing this book?
There are two things that stand out to me about the book that I would want people to know about. The first is to recognize that gay experience, gay lives, gay history didn't happen separated off from the rest of American life. The story here of where did a gay political movement come from is not a story of just what happened to gay people and how they were beaten up by the police and decided to do something about it. I mean, that's part of the story. But the tools that they used were lessons that they drew from the community around them, from these artists and leftists who lived there in the neighborhood with them. Our experience as gay people is woven in to the story of America. And we shouldn't think about it as boxed off. We should think of it as part of that broader story. That's one thing that's important to me. The other thing that's important to me is to recognize the way these potentially very different seeming people, artists, active political leftist communists, and homosexual men and women, who we wouldn't necessarily assume had common cause, found a way to work together. In a way, the book represents to me a kind of progressive coalition where people found issues that linked them. They found out that their way of thinking about different things pulled them together. And the fact that these different groups could come together and change America, which I think they did, says to me, we can build coalitions with people who we don't necessarily think are like us, and together with them, make change happen.
What change would you like to see happen?
Well, I'd like to live in a world where we saw greater justice and equality for minorities, and certainly greater economic equality in our country. To me, the economic imbalances of the country are the most troubling for me. Certainly as someone who used to live in New Orleans, I've seen both the poverty of that city before the hurricane and the devastation of it afterwards. And I know that is just one snapshot of how much there remains great inequities in our society. And I would love to see change happen in which Americans more and more work together to undo those inequities.
Daniel, thank you so much for coming to the studio and talking to us.
Vivian, it's been a treat to get a talk with you, and I really appreciate your inviting me to be here.
What is a queer space? As queers, how do we experience and inhabit space? After struggling through centuries of marginalization and oppression, today, massive rainbow flags flutter boldly from our commercial capital of gayness, the Castro District of San Francisco. Pride flags soar above Citibank, while extravagant cafe patios teem with pairs of affluent male professionals. At the same moment, a dozen blocks away, trans women of color who have been systematically denied housing and jobs are rounded up into a police van outside of a bar that is undergoing renovation. As queers, how do we transform space?
In this story of the Polk Street area of the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, Puck Lowe and gay shame activist Marry About Something explore gentrification and the queer politics of race and class.
The Tenderloin is one of the few remaining working-class neighborhoods near downtown San Francisco. This neighborhood has long been a center of sexuality, boasting strip clubs since the early 1900s. Prior to the emergence of the Castro as the main gay hub, the Polk Gulch at the western side of the Tenderloin was the city's first gay neighborhood. One of the first gay riots, preempting the Stonewall riots in New York, exploded at Compton's Cafeteria at Turk and Taylor Streets in August 1966. The police, attempting to arrest a drag queen, sparked a riot that spilled into the streets. Since the 1980s and 90s, queers, homeless people, drug users, and sex workers have made the Polk Street area home and have fueled a queer street culture. Rents in this area are more affordable in a city that is among the most expensive in the country. The Tenderloin is home to many recent immigrants as well, notably Hmong, Vietnamese, and Mexican families. Alejandro Hurtado is one Polk Gulch resident.
As a queer man of color, I think of the Polk Street as one of the few public spaces for queer men of color, because people of color tend to be paid less than their white counterparts. And seeing that San Francisco is a city of beacon for all folks in the rainbow, we kind of also break down according to class as well. And I found that the Tenderloin is that safe haven for the working class, young, queer men of color, as well as monolingual transgender Latinas. It is a space safe to them because they've carved it out, and they're continuing to do so.
Queers without money, transgender, gender variant, and intersex people who face housing and job discrimination elsewhere have fought and won space to exist within the Tenderloin. This despite facing obstacles such as predatory landlords, homophobic police officers, and a general lack of social and health services. Mary About Something is part of the queer direct action group, Gay Shame. Gay Shame has been working for 5 years to expose and shame business owners who've recently bought out historic gay and tranny hangout spots in the Polk Gulch area. About Something explains why Polk Street needs to remain intact.
It's an important space because mainstream gay culture completely excludes people who are homeless, people who are trans, and people who are sex workers and people who are drug addicts.
Alexis Miranda and Victoria's Secret both bartend at Divas, a spacious and comfortable bar on the corner of Polk and Post Streets. Miranda has been with Divas for 21 years when it was first called the Motherlode. It is the only transgender club in the entire state of California. For decades, bars have been the places where queer culture has flourished in the city. Don Romsberg of the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Historical Society explains.
Bars were one of the only public gathering places that people could openly let their hair down and be themselves. In the 1950s and 1960s, you still faced a great deal of street harassment and intimidation, and you were discriminated against in every facet of society, and so bars were a critical gathering spot.
Miranda at Divas provides another reason why bars have been so important to Polk Gulch residents.
San Francisco, because it is so crowded and expensive, most people who live in hotels, studios, or one bedrooms, bars and coffee houses, the reason they exist is because that's everybody's living room. You can't have a house party of 10 people in a studio.
But like the rest of San Francisco, the Tenderloin, and especially the Polk Gulch, is changing one bar at a time. Miranda reminisces about what the Polk Gulch was like in 1986.
There was Ben-Hur, there was the locker room, there was just up and down Polk Street, and that's where everybody was. The Motherlode was just on the corner for the transgenders.
When the HIV/AIDS epidemic hit the neighborhood, real estate agents waged concerted campaigns to evict scores of people living with HIV/AIDS and subsequently drove up rent prices. Parts of Polk Street now cater to the newest influx of young professionals who are moving into the neighborhood and buying up properties. Gentrification is the process whereby working-class residents in an area are forced to leave due to an increase in the cost of living that is caused by people with money moving in, buying properties and using laws and police in order to remove poor people and all visible signs of poverty. According to Miranda, 30 gay bars once existed in the neighborhood. Now there are around 10. In the past few years, new bars like Vertigo, Hemlock, and Lush Lounge have opened to cater to a new crowd. Affluent, often straight, metrosexuals. Men who appropriate aspects of gay aesthetics. We'll be right back. when cultural centers such as the gay and trans bars of Polk Street disappear, and new residents move in who may be anti-poor, transphobic, homophobic, or racist, then low-income queers who rely on the area to be home, and many who have been living and working in the neighborhood for decades are forced to scatter and suffer in isolation. Tommy Avakoli Mecca, a longtime tenants' rights and queer activist with the Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco, explains some of the racial dynamics of gentrification.
You know, in the 60s, there was all this talk about white flight from the big cities. Supposedly, all these white people moved out because they wanted to live in the suburbs. You know, but what it was really about was they wanted to get away from African Americans. It was really all about racism. And now, I think the reverse has started happening in the 90s, where now all these folks that fled out there want to come back in into the cities. And in order to do that, they've got to displace the people who are living in the cities. And the real estate people accommodate them.
But gentrification is not a crisis resulting from a housing shortage or the migration of peoples. Nicholas Pagulatos is part of the Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition. Pagulatos explains how San Francisco city policies chose to drive out low-income people in order to cater to the wealthy.
One, it did nothing to really deal with issues of displacement. Two, it actively moved to provide new areas to develop high-end housing.
Victoria's Secret has been living and working in San Francisco, mostly in the Polk Gulch area, for 16 years. According to Miranda, Divas, because it is a transgender nightclub, has been unfairly singled out and harassed by the new residents and others who conflate being transgender with being a prostitute.
When he first opened up, myself, Mark, and Paul, which at the time were the employees here, ran across the street to welcome him and everything else and, you know, buy a drink. And he ran to the door and told us that our kind was not wanted there and threw us out. And I'm a very predominant person in the city, but he told me that I need to get myself and my girls off of his street, my horse.
Around the corner from Divas, next to a public housing building, is the Case and Abst Architect's Office. The contact listed on the website for the Lower Polk neighbors leads here. Inside, a pastel decor dulls the senses, and soft jazz fills the air while men in button-up shirts type on glowing laptops. Lower Polk Neighbors is an association comprised of merchants, landlords, and residents that formed 5 years ago. In their quest for cleanliness, beautification, and the strengthening of the community, LPN has called for increased policing and harsher punishments to remove prostitutes and drug users from the area. Anti-gentrification activists like Gay Shame allege that Lower Polk Neighbors' neighborly concern is a thinly veiled rallying cry for social cleansing. At the Bar Divas, Miranda and bar patrons discuss homophobia and transphobia among the police.
A good friend of mine was pulled out of a car. Melanie was pulled out of a car through her hair simply for double parking, waiting for a girlfriend of hers to get into the car. And the cop pulled her out through the window.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And she sued him for... It took forever, but she didn't get anything out of it, of course.
Polk Street resident Hurtado says that policing won't create safety for the queer and trans residents in the Polk Street area who don't have money.
I think having more police officers isn't going to make poverty less poor. It's not going to create more economic independence for those people who are working on the street.
Avakoli Mecca at Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco thinks that queers need to organize against gentrification and reclaim the queer agenda from business interests and politicians.
Many of us who are working class and poor are saying housing, living wage jobs, you know, access to universal health care. These are the burning issues for the queer community. But it's hard for us to compete against headlines every week in the queer papers saying, you know, right to marry threatened, blah, 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 blah. So I think that's how they've been able to influence the agenda. They've been able to set the agenda of the movement. They've been basically taken over our movement, which used to be street people, used to be the people on the streets that determine what our issues were. But not anymore. It's the people in the queer media. It's the people, the corporate types who are now on the commissions, who get appointed, you know, by the politicians, who are supported by the big money in the community.
One way that people fight gentrification is by organizing against landlords. Claire Sandberg-Bernard works with the San Francisco Tenants Union. The union has been waging a campaign against city apartments, the largest landlord in San Francisco, and thus hugely responsible for gentrifying the city.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The Association of Black Psychology's 39th Annual International Convention will be held at the Hilton, America's Downtown, from August 1st to 5th, 2007. During the 39th Annual Convention, the community is invited to join local and national psychologists, community advocates, research scholars, healthcare professionals, university professors, students, and elected officials as part of an interactive town hall meeting entitled Revitalizing and Reclaiming Our Community. The town hall meeting will be held on Thursday, August 2nd from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Shrine of the Black Madonna at 5309 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Houston. Again, the Association of Black Psychology's 39th Annual International Convention will be held at the Hilton America's Downtown from August 1st to 5th, 2007.
KPFT, Houston.
Some say the internet has hurt the art of letter writing, but here at KPFT, stamps still get the love and respect they deserve. Did you know you could write to your favorite shows, request a program schedule, or just share your ideas on programming, outreach, and more? Quick, write this down. KPFT's address is 419th Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006. You can send a...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.